Andy Garland is a Canadian playwright. He's based in Vancouver, British Columbia. He's the author of Thorold Community Theatre's current production, And Then the Lights Went Out. Andy, how are you? And thanks for joining us today.
I'm doing quite well today there, Jim. How about yourself?
Doing fine, Andy. Thanks for asking. How's life on the West Coast these days?
Vancouver is significantly drenched in rain, which should surprise absolutely nobody at this point in time. We did get through a lovely Halloween parade, and now I'm just settling in for the long winter ahead.
Got lots of work on your plate.
Plenty of work on my plate here. I've always got several scripts on the go, as well as I'm constantly writing, directing, and editing my own podcast, Duggan Hill, which is a horror series set in Canada.
Tell us a bit about that Duggan Hill podcast. That sounds interesting.
Duggan Hill started out as an idea between me and one of my favorite actors out in Vancouver, Kelsey Ranshaw. And we built that into a serialized story. We're on our third season right now. I think the basic notion was to take Lovecraftian mythos and monsters, you know, those strange, unknowable creatures that go bump in the night, and take out the racism, take out all the baggage that comes with that, and then set it in Canada. So we have our own horror stories to tell, as it were. Season one was all set in a remote town of Duggan Hill, Saskatchewan, and season two moved back over onto the West Coast to explore the ramifications of what happened in season one. And we still kept on picking blue listers every week, so onwards and onwards we go.
Fascinating. Tell us a little bit about the work that Andy Garland does besides writing radio dramas for Thorold Community Theatre.
Aside from writing radio dramas, I'm also a working screenwriter and playwright. I also still have my day job working for TELUS as what I like to call a financial mortician. So whenever somebody dies or goes bankrupt, I go in and I make sure their accounts are closed out. It helps pay the bills, keeps the light on, and gives me time to work on things that I'm really passionate about, like creating new works like the ones you're working on today here.
What about the stage writing and playwriting side of Andy Garland? What sort of work do you do in that world?
I've been writing plays for well over a decade, and then I moved up to Vancouver to pursue a screenwriting career about 10 years ago this year. So that's brought me out this way. I've written plays covering the gamut from kids, you know, taking their year off between high school and college trying to figure themselves out, play studying democracy when voting rights are curtailed or restricted. I like to change up the genres every so often just to keep things fresh. And whenever I find a story that really intrigues or compels me, I will dive into it as much as I can. For example, one of my latest plays I wrote, Juice, was all about pyramid schemes. What happens to a pyramid scheme when it completely falls apart? So I let myself be invited to about 5 or 6 different meetings to recruit people into pyramid schemes. I had to let them pitch to me nonstop and just immerse myself in their world of, you just get 3 friends under you, they get 3 friends under them. Before you know it, you're making so much money. You get a car in no time. Okay, I'm impressed you believe this stuff, but go on.
Well, those people never leave you alone. So you do a bit of research. You're in pretty deep now.
Yeah.
You have to change your phone number.
I got in deep, but I got what I needed, and I wrote a wonderful one-act play about 4 people involved in these pyramid schemes dealing with the fallout in one hotel room in one night, and I'm still looking to remount that somewhere time out in Vancouver once our theater scene is more proactively getting back on its feet there. I know that now we got some plays going, which is wonderful, but we still had seating restrictions, so
yeah.
I think in 2022 it might be worth pursuing that to get Juice back up on its feet in earnest here.
Cool. Sounds like an interesting idea. Any television credits to your name?
We are still shopping around the TV version of Duggan Hill.
Okay.
And I've written a couple of science fiction movies that are currently in pre-production, one with the Canadian company and one over in the UK. And I'm still shopping around some other ideas through my agent at Webster Talent there.
Neat. All right. Cool. I can't wait to see those. Well, the play that we're dealing with here is called And Then the Lights Went Out. It's a bit of a departure for us. We're doing it as a radio drama. And, you know, of course, the COVID restrictions meant that we weren't sure at the time when we were planning this whether we'd be able to sell tickets to a show or not, even whether we'd be able to mount a radio production because of the challenges of trying to record it all remotely. But we decided to jump in. Let's talk a little bit about the play itself before we get into some of the mechanics on it. It's basically a story about an author who, probably fair to say, is struggling with writer's block. He's trying to finish his latest novel. Most of the action takes place in the author's apartment, but it switches back and forth between three real-life characters and four characters, I guess you could characterize them as figments of the author's imagination, characters in his novel. How did you come up with that idea for a story, and is it like autobiographical in any way?
I'd say parts of it are semi-autobiographical. The first production was in 2009. I was writing it up until that point there. And right at the very start, I won the Special Merit Prize in the Canadian National Playwriting Competition. And immediately I was like, okay, great. Now what do I do? It wasn't for this play. It was for a different one. But I was kind of stuck afterwards and just stalled out wondering, how do I follow that up? Can I still keep on writing good material? Where do I go from here? And this play was partially born out of that, trying to find my next step, as it were. I was definitely dealing with a lot of writer's block at a time. I put the script away and didn't look at it for an entire year after the fact. But in college, my buddy Dennis Kaufman, who later on would portray the role of Bruno, stepped in and gave me some jokes and some advice, and he helped shape the character of Bruno, which we now consider to be like one of the beating hearts of the play itself. There, so I have to give him credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually it was picked up by the Black Knight Inn Dinner Theater in Red Deer, Alberta for their first production. And it's been evolving with every single production since that point in time, up until now, where it's made the jump from stage play to radio play.
And we're proud to be the ones doing that. Thank you very much. Appreciate the work on that.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a sec, too. I'm a writer. I'm a journalist, not a creative writer. But I know when I finish a story, it's finished. I close the computer, put it away, and I never go back and look at it again. But do you do that? I mean, you've got a live piece of work here, live characters that you can tinker with, tweak, reinvent, reimagine. Does a play have several life cycles for a writer like yourself?
I think so. I mean, I keep revisiting it year after year and seeing where things have changed, where I've changed, and I think there have been some tweaks that have made to the script over the years that have made it stronger overall. Jokes fade over time and they age out. I'm like, okay, that didn't quite land 10 years ago. What's something fresh we can put in that'll keep it relevant for modern audiences today, for example? And I've definitely done that work on this play, especially with the jump to radio adaptation. I had a chance to go through it front to back, cover to cover, and find not only where can we amp up the jokes and make them stronger, but also how can the addition of the new narrator character alter the dynamic and the chemistry between all the characters on board as well here too. And like I said, it's many plays, you close the book on them, they're done, they're a moment in time that you were there writing them, and that's good, that's fine. But this play has been with me for a decade now, and I don't think it's done quite yet, so I want to keep on revisiting it until finally we get it published. In that case, maybe I will take a break and stop tweaking with it. But until then, I'm happy to keep on revisiting. But you know what? Yeah, this scene could be a bit shorter, or this scene could be a bit longer. Or let's give Duke one more line. Why not?
Okay. This seems fair. It was originally written, of course, as a stage play. We've said that. How did you stage the interaction between the real-life characters and the imaginary characters? There's times in the play where Thomas is having conversations in the same room with his evil landlady and Bruno and Jim, the detective in the story. So how did you stage that so the audience knew what was going on?
In the first production, which was a big old dinner theater stage, the walls between the fictional world and the real world on the stage there were very, very thin. Aside from like a change in lighting when we're in full-on like fictional world mode, the fictional characters invaded the space with no regard whatsoever to Thomas, the author, or anyone else around there. All of our nonfiction characters, like Thomas's landlady, his neighbor, had to act like the characters weren't there whatsoever. Further productions have played up certain aspects of that world or not. I believe the production in Edmonton that David Johnson directed for the Walterdale Playhouse, he brought in for the larger crowd scenes mannequins dressed up like goons or private detectives or cops.
And interesting.
And that's how he staged a grandiose final gun battle, not to spoil anything there, that just had the audience in stitches laughing, because you'd have mannequins popping out of windows and doors and then being pulled back when they were shot. It was utterly hilarious. So I think every director's put their individual stamp on this play with regards to how they treat that barrier between the fictional world and the non-fictional. And every time I've seen it, I've seen almost every production that's occurred of this one, I've always loved it.
the window's wide open for imagination there for a director. They can, you know, where can they take that? It's almost limitless. That's cool. So how did you get this into radio? We've only got one medium, and that's sound. We can't use lighting. We can't stick mannequins in and out of windows, unfortunately. It'd be kind of cool if we could do that. But how did you conceive of the narrator and bring this to a point where you could tell the entire story clearly with just words?
I have to credit my parents for that, because when I was young, they took us to a family cabin in Saskatchewan with no television, only the radio. So my video game addicted self was very, very much distraught. But they had radio plays on the local AM channels well into the evening, old murder mysteries, you know, with the gumshoes and the private eyes and the like. And just remembering how they portrayed those in like an old timey way, but still, I mean, back then it was done live. You had a studio, people lined up with various gadgets to make the noises, and everyone standing by, a band ready to play the cues. And that I drew a lot from. For this, the narrator character is a very fresh addition. And I wanted it to be a part of the world itself. So it's the narrator of the book that Thomas is experimenting with writing in for himself there. And that, I think, played well with everyone else. I had to strip back some of the action sequences or make sure that they could be represented through sound. And where I couldn't represent things through sound, whether it was the clinking of a glass or what have you, I brought back in the narrator. I wanted to give them as much of the whiskey-soaked, you know, dime store novel aura that I possibly could for this there. And while still having some self-awareness that, oh, yes, I am a disembodied voice that's narrating the action.
Well, I think the narrator is one of the strongest characters in the play.
Excellent.
I mean, the guy who we have reading the part, Richard Andrews, nice, rich baritone voice. He comes across as taking himself really seriously in his role. And yet, you know, often sort of finds himself stumbling because he realizes he's not part of it all. It's an interesting way he's played the character. But are you a fan of radio drama? I mean, just letting your imagination work. I mean, TV and movies have taken that away from us. We hardly ever use our imagination anymore. If we read, we've got a good imagination. I'm wondering, people in 2021, are we prepared for this? Or do people find it kind of shocking when they don't have all the visuals that go along with the story?
I think they're ready to be pleasantly surprised by it there. I mean, there's plenty of folks listening to podcast content, whether it be unraveling a cold case murder or listening to a serialized podcast that is a story week after week after week. Without the visual elements, our brains have to replace that. And I think sometimes that could be a richer experience for it there. Like when I wrote first season of Duggan Hill, our monster sound effects were very limited and the audience got to fill in the rest just with cues. We put like, okay, here's what the monster looks like. Here's what it sounds like. You fill in the blanks on the rest of it there. And sometimes less detail provided by the author allows them to fill in the blanks themselves more detail. And it's everyone's personal listening experience that they can identify with. It's not just, okay, that's on the screen, that's what it is. It's cut and dried, go. This is a little more malleable, I think. And I think that is really one of the strengths of the audio drama. You can picture what they look like. You can picture how they move and what they're wearing to a degree. You can shape that experience as you're listening to it, and your brain is a little more engaged when it's doing so, I think.
And it's going to be a unique experience for every listener for that exact reason.
Exactly, exactly. They're still going to hear all the same things,
yep.
But in their mind, that's going to inform something completely different based on everything that's already inside there.
Well, I think Peter Jackson took a heck of a chance when he decided to go out and film Lord of the Rings. I've seen various, you know, movies called Lord of the Rings over the years and never came away satisfied, because my own reading of those books, my characters looked a certain way, and I was always disappointed with what I saw on screen until Peter Jackson came along. But is that a risk for a writer, that people aren't going to get what they're doing in a play like this where you have to imagine some of it?
I suppose there's always a risk involved there, but there's steps you can take to mitigate that risk. If your descriptions are clear and if your scenes are concise, I think that people will be engaged enough to follow along. And I think that those that stick with it will be very much rewarded, I think. Is it for everyone? Absolutely not. And that is okay. It doesn't have to be, but the radio drama format has survived for decades upon decades. And sure, it's had some peaks and some valleys, but now it's more accessible than ever. You don't need to tune in at a specific date, specific time to hear, you know, War of the Worlds terrorize everyone. Now you can dial it up on your phone, usually for free, and you're good to go. So I think that anyone who's willing to dip their toes into it there is going to find a wealth of engaging stories just waiting for them.
Well, I admit we've had some difficulty explaining to people how to buy tickets for this. You know, they're used to going online, paying their two bits and getting a ticket and then showing up at a door at a certain time. So now they're saying, well, like, do I have to listen at Friday night at 8 o'clock? I said, no, you can, here's the pass. You can dial in anytime you want. You can listen to it in the car, on the radio at home, in the bathroom. Go nuts. Just like, oh, okay. You know, so it's going to be a bit of a new experience for our audience. That's for sure.
Yeah.
We're encouraging people to have listening parties, you know, sit down with the family, gather around the stereo and do it like we don't have the old Philco radios anymore, unfortunately, but, you know, get people to sit around and turn it up and listen as a group, just, you know, experience it. Well, listen, Andy, thanks for sharing some of that with us about And Then the Lights Went Out. Appreciate your insights in it, and I'm glad you explained a few of those bits to us. It'll help the understanding of the attendees of the play, I think.
Well, thank you so much for having me on here, Jim. I appreciate you and all the work you're doing on the play, and I can't wait to hear the finished product.
I think you'll be pleasantly surprised, if I may say so myself. We did a heck of a job. The cast we have for amateur actors, I mean, don't forget, this is community theater. But you'd be hard-pressed to tell that this is community theater by listening to it. They really outdid themselves on this one.
Wonderful, wonderful. I've met them virtually once already there, and I got to say I was impressed by the rehearsal I got to sit in on. So.
Well, you'll be among the first to hear it. You'll get a preview before we actually go live, I hope.
Oh, my.
Andy Garland is the author of And Then the Lights Went Out. That's Thorold Community Theater's fall production, an audio drama this time, a little bit of a change of pace for us. You can pick up your listening pass to hear the show at thorldtheater.ca. Hope you join us, and Andy, thank you for spending a bit of time with us this afternoon. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jim. Have yourself a wonderful rest of your Thursday there.